You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, guys. Welcome back to the show. Up next is our friend Adam Morrow on the line from Cairo, Egypt. Welcome back, Adam. How are you?
Good, Scott. Thank you. Glad to be back.
Very happy to have you here. Adam writes for Interpress Service. It's ipsnews.net, although honestly, I forgot to even check your archive and see if you have any new ones up there, Adam.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
Do you have any new ones up there?
I haven't been filing anything lately, unfortunately. But I promised you last time, I will definitely get on that.
Yeah. You got a history to report on
skeptical.
Going on there.
You
got a real life and a real job, too, but is what it is. We got to know. And anyway, at least I get to have you on the show, and you get to tell us, about Egypt's march back to democracy since military thankfully overthrew the elected government of that country in order to restore it, according to our Secretary of State. Going pretty well?
Not so much, actually. If the last time we spoke, we haven't spoken in a while. I think it was probably before the whole Gaza stuff.
Yeah, I think
happened,
so, yeah.
I think
it may even been before ISIS sacked Mosul.
I think it was probably after that, but not very much long after that. It was probably the last time we spoke.
Yeah, a couple months.
But if you remember, even then, I was saying that after a very euphoric beginning to the military takeover here that happened, 14, 15 months ago in July of last year. Since that time, President Sisi, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi's popularity has waned really, really badly because, I mean, he was expected, like his predecessors, he was sort of expected to immediately solve all these longstanding chronic problems that Egypt has had all of these decades, and he hasn't been able to do that. So his popularity has waned a lot in the last year alone. And I think in an effort to do that, they're sort of taking steps now on the domestic front. They're focusing on two things, and one of them is to sort of distract everybody's attention with talk of terrorism, both domestic and regional. And the other is to embark on maybe these glory projects. Like they just unveiled 2 or 3 weeks ago, they just unveiled a vast new Suez Canal project that will allow several more ships to dock inside the canal or something like that. Mm-hmm. And that's been sort of rolled out amid tremendous fanfare and is being touted as a huge achievement by the leader. I mean, it hasn't been built yet or anything. I think it'll be built over the course of the next couple of years. But I mean, a lot of economists and stuff like that have come out and saying that there was actually no real reason to even build this thing, and that it was, I mean, it's entirely a vanity project, and it's being interpreted largely as a desperate attempt to sort of to bolster his popularity, which, as I said, has been on the wane for the last couple of months. You still have skyrocketing inflation is out of control. You just had big subsidy cuts on fuel prices, which sent fuel prices going up by 50%, 70% in some cases, which just affected inflation further. So you have all of these traditional complaints that still have yet to be solved. So we're basically as we said last time, we're basically back. In terms of public, resentment, we're sort of back to where we were right before the 2011 election. It's almost as if that never happened, with a lot of promises from the new government that things will get better. And, the public is being urged to wait and be patient and all of this sort of thing. But we're right back where we were on January 24th, 2011 at this point.
Yeah, it's sad. And, of course, the problem is my funny bone is just completely shattered at this point. And so the sarcasm, I guess, wasn't apparent to you probably or anybody in the audience either. Of course, I was just trying to mock the position of the U.S. government that it was the restoration of democracy when the military canceled the results of the presidential election and put its winner in prison. Not that I was ever pro-Muslim Brotherhood or anything, but it seemed like that was the progress of the Arab Spring in Egypt. We're going to have elections, real ones now, but no.
Maybe I've been in Egypt too long, but that's the here. A lot of people wouldn't take that sarcastically and would take it seriously. What you said about the return to democracy.
It sounds like. Do you mean to say that they're the people who really hated the Muslim Brotherhood that much, even though they had won the election? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying the media did such a job on the public here. For months and even years, even since Morsi's time and before Morsi being the president who was ousted a year ago, Mohamed Morsi, the media has been consistently attacking the Brotherhood. For example, we have these, we've been suffering from these intermittent power cuts. We're getting four or five, it's better now, but at the height, maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, four or five power cuts, hour-long power cuts a day, all across Cairo. And that went on for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. I mean, it was really, really getting bad. And then I think 3 or 4 days ago, there was a massive, massive power outage. The entire grid was somehow affected. And there was a huge, huge, like, semi-country. Well, it wasn't countrywide, but it was, like, large swaths of the country when power went down for several hours. So that's and that's something that Morsi was consistently being, you know, was consistently being blamed for during his time. The media was constantly attacking him and in the media for being unable to provide a simple basic service like electricity. And now you have, you know, a year after his ouster, you still have the same problem, and it's even worse. It's even getting worse. In fact, Sisi came on television yesterday and sort of made an appeal to the public to be patient about these power outages, and you even have, you know, the hardcore elements of the government and the pro army camp are saying that it's like Muslim Brotherhood cells that are sabotaging the power network. So it's like every single thing, you know, this is a demonization of the Brotherhood has been going on for so long now, for months, years. And unfortunately, there are large swaths of the population that really, really buy into this stuff. Like,
well, now,
I watch some of this stuff.
Let me ask you this.
Or, like, an educated Egyptian watches some of this stuff, and he'll laugh at how ridiculous this anti-Ikhwan propaganda is, you know?
Yeah.
But you can't forget that at the same time, tens of millions of very simple Egyptians who maybe aren't as educated actually buy into it. I sort of learned that recently. I didn't realize how powerful the draw that the state media has here. But really, tens of millions of people rely on the state media here and actually believe it's you know, these ridiculous lies, most of which have been aimed at the Brotherhood for the past 2 years.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, so one of, I guess, what sounds, at least to my Western ears, like one of the more powerful pieces of propaganda against them is that they really tried to not just put all their guys in every appointed position they possibly could, you know, change over to their thing. But they really tried to, you know, Talibanize the government and enforce, you know, as much of their Islamist doctrine as they possibly could in terms of clamping down on people's kind of personal and professional behavior in a way that was considered way out of bounds, where they really should have been just working on solidifying their power, making as many alliances as they could, even with the liberals, as we've talked about before, that they, you know, basically it would be like having Pat Robertson come to power with super majorities in both House of Congress and just, you know, legislate every right-wing, born-again Taliban thing they could come up with against the rest of us in America. That's at least the way it's portrayed. But is that not true, that the Muslim Brotherhood passed a bunch of that kind of personal stuff?
That's actually a huge misconception. That's something that's the sort of thing that I see all the time repeated ad infinitum in the media about Morsi's disastrous year in power, in which he showed himself to be this authoritarian and tried to, like, foist Islamist rules and make everybody, you know, follow his way of thinking. And all. That's actually not the case at all. They actually were bending over backwards. Morsi in particular and the Brotherhood in general were bending over backwards to ensure everybody, or to reassure everybody that they were not going to that they weren't going to change anything that would affect personal freedoms. There was no intention to go after alcohol, the sale of alcohol, for example. There was no intention to touch dress codes in any way. Now, a valid criticism. Remember, the Brotherhood have always been gradualists.
All right, now, I'm sorry, hold it right there. Hold it right there. Sure. Very important point to pick up on the other side of this break. We're on the phone with Adam Morrow from Interpress Service, IPSnews.net, reporting live from Cairo on the restoration of military rule in Egypt. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. I want to tell you about this great new book, Living La Vida Baroca, American Culture in an Age of Imperial Orthodoxies by Thomas Harrington. While he comes from the left, Harrington has little time for much of what is passed off under that label today. Like us libertarians, he puts peace and freedom first. The book's got great essays on American fascism, empire, the Israeli occupation, the left and Obama, liberalism in the state, and some interesting lessons from the history of Imperial Spain. Living La Vida Baroca by Thomas Harrington. Check it out at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. And I'm talking with Adam Morrow from Interpress Service, living in Cairo, Egypt. And, you know, in a way, it's my fault. I'm sure I forget at which point I screwed this up, Adam. But this whole conversation we're having is beside the point. Nothing would justify the Egyptian military overthrowing the government as they did a year and a couple of months ago there. So talking about
something would justify it, Scott, if crimes were being committed against the people and that sort of thing. If there were actual crimes being committed by this elected government, then there would be a legitimate reason for the military to step in. But there weren't.
Hell, even then, there ought to be civilian processes for exchanges of power. You know, like impeachment or that, you know, something along those lines without a coup. But anyway, point being you know, they can demonize the Muslim Brotherhood all they want. And you're saying that, you know, a whole lot of that, the mess of it is not even really true. You're conceding
that.
It was
just a massive exaggeration. It was a massive exaggeration, Scott, that the Western media actually sort of played a big part in. There was very, very little critical analysis of what. There was very little explanation of why Morsi was doing some of the things he was doing. For example, a decree that he issued that basically overrode the judiciary and gave him greater powers in November of 2012 was almost inevitably described as a power grab in the Western media, without any real explanation as to why he needed to override the judiciary, the Mubarak judiciary, in the first place, because the Mubarak era judiciary was stalling all of this legislation that he needed in order to get parliamentary elections going, et cetera, et cetera. So there were valid reasons. He had valid reasons for doing some of these things, and they were just entirely either, you know, they were misinterpreted or they were willingfully misinterpreted, mm-hmm. and certainly spun in a very dishonest way, both especially in the domestic media here and in the international media.
Yeah, which is interesting because, you know, if you read the New York Times closely, you'll see that they would concede that the judiciary is simply a bastion of military power within the government that absolutely was an obstacle in every way. That's not really in dispute. It's just not included in the narrative. Right.
Yet Morsi is constantly criticized for his. The main criticism was that he tried to get all the power in his hands by issuing this decree that overrode the judiciary, and that's the main point why everybody always says his authoritarian rule. You know, that was his rule that was marked by authoritarianism. They're constantly harping on the authoritarian thing, and it's really, yes, he did make an authoritarian move to make, but there were reasons for it. There were valid reasons for it, and unfortunately, in this era. You know, in the current era of mass media that we have now, you seldom hear the real reasons why. If they don't want you to know them, you won't hear what the real reasons why people are doing things. You know, they'll just be sort of casually written off as a power grab or something very simple that doesn't convey the actual, you know, the actual meaning behind them.
Mm. All right. And now when Field Marshal Sisi did the coup last year, is it your understanding that America was really behind that or... with a wink and a nod, or they actually supported it, Iran 53 style, or what?
We've debated this in the past, and it's not sure. It's until now, it's sort of uncertain. It's sort of an open question, just how much they knew. I personally think it's impossible that they didn't know. All signs would point. And if they didn't want it to happen, I mean, I don't think it would have happened. It was done with the explicit. It was quarterbacked. by America's very, very close allies in the region, mm-hmm. being Saudi and the Emirates in particular. So, I mean, the American connection is the U.S. didn't play much of a role, but I'm sure they knew it.
Well, you know, the reason I ask it that way is there's been a
and
lot of.
And if you look at what they said. Well, it's interesting if you look at what happened in the wake of the coup as well. A similar thing sort of happened that happened in the wake of the January 25th revolution in 2011. The U.S. sort of didn't know which way to go. You know, it was sort of caught between supporting an elected president and supporting what the Egyptians were calling this popular revolution. Mm-hmm. You know, so the U.S. itself sort of went back and forth. But up until now, it continues to say it continues to describe Sisi as the guy who's going to bring democracy to Egypt, right. And the guy who's
that
put
really,
Egypt back on the democratic path.
I wanted to ask you about the reason I had asked you about America's role in the coup was just because there was, you know, had been some hype about how America's diminished influence now, even Egypt. Our former loyal sock puppet, dictatorship under Mubarak is now closer to Saudi and UAE, as you said, and they don't even pay much attention to America anymore. And, you know, part of that is just, you know, right-wing hype about Obama's a feckless president and this kind of, red herring stuff. But I wonder whether there was some truth to that. But then again, I would also add that it doesn't seem like there's any daylight whatsoever between Egypt and Israel right now. So if that's any indication, they're just as much in America's pocket as ever. But what do you think of that?
Yeah, it's a very weird dynamic. I mean, there's definitely distance between Israel and the U.S. as well, because in the wake of Gaza, I mean, during Gaza, the U.S. was getting like really embarrassed by Israel's actions. You know, it was getting, I mean, they were really getting, even the U.S. was getting pissed off, you could tell. You know, with John Kerry getting caught saying that, he said something on the, he sort of got caught on camera, you know, very upset about something that had happened. And then there was, the U.S. was actually using some unprecedented language. I think they described something as, something that Israel did as I can't remember the exact word, but it was an unprecedented use of language by the U.S. In criticism of critical of Israel. So there's definitely space has definitely opened up over there, and I definitely think there is some truth to the idea that Egypt is moving away from the U.S. orbit and moving closer to these Gulf states, which are also very closely aligned with Israel now. Mm-hmm. I think there is. It's incredibly confusing. But there is something to that. There is something to the idea that Egypt is moving away from, is moving out of the U.S. orbit, though, as are Saudi and the Emirates, and they seem to be sort of more in line with the hardcore, the hard right Israelis than they are with Obama's Washington, at least.
Yeah. All right. So tell me briefly about the domestic police state in Egypt now.
Sorry, say that again, Scott?
Tell me about the domestic police state there, the emergency laws and torture and that kind of thing.
Well, it's really bad. I mean, reports are constantly emerging of torture. There have been torture videos are popping up on YouTube all the time. You've got constant criticisms and condemnations coming out from human rights organizations and things like that. But, I mean, none of that seems to – they don't seem to care. They don't seem to care, you know, the way they spin it is like this, you know, they're in the middle of like an existential fight with terrorism.
Yeah, as Rudy Giuliani said, it all depends who's doing
it. They're trying to draw a parallel between the Brotherhood here and the Islamic State phenomenon in the Levant, you know, so they're trying to turn the whole and the Libyan Islamist militias in Libya. They're trying to draw them all as this part of this huge international Islamist onslaught that like only these like, you know, hard ass generals can stop. And even Sisi has just recently come out just within the last day or two talking about like a pan-Arab military alliance in order to fight extremism.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
so it's sounding pretty grim.
Yeah, I mean, they're saying that ISIS is in Sinai now. So not just terrorists, but the Islamic State is there. And do you think there's any truth to that?
Doesn't surprise me at all. Personally, I'm extremely suspicious about the whole Islamic State phenomenon. And I think it would highly, highly dubious that they would have guys in Sinai. I mean, basically, you can attribute anything to Sinai because Sinai is like locked down, and we have it's like a war zone, and we have no idea what's going on there. And because it shares borders with both Israel and the Gaza Strip, so it's like incredibly sensitive. And you've got the smuggling tunnels, and you've got all this stuff going on. Like anything can be attributed to Sinai, you know. I mean, there was this phase where people were calling it Egypt's Tora Bora. I mean, just typical sensationalist, you know, nonsense. So, like anything could be. It doesn't surprise me at all that ridiculous people would say that that the Islamic State is now beheading people in Sinai. That wouldn't surprise me at all. But I mean, that's ridiculous.
Well, I don't think they went that far necessarily. What I read didn't have beheadings, but yeah, I mean, all it takes is one goofball raising a black flag, and then. You can spin it however you want. You want a whole new war?
Yeah,
you
exactly.
Can justify
exactly.
It.
No, a couple of decapitated bodies were found in Sinai about a week ago.
Oh, okay.
And,
no,
yeah,
I hadn't seen it.
And immediately the first thing everybody did was being like, oh, but there's still no evidence that ISIS is in Sinai, you know, but still managing to raise the specter.
Right. And, you know, Netanyahu, of course, equates Hamas with ISIS. And yet when an Al-Qaeda loyal group poked its head up in Hamas about 2 or 3 years ago, I guess now, in the Gaza Strip, Hamas went and killed them in a day, or a couple of dozen of them or
that's
something.
That's right.
Completely.
That's
eliminated.
Right. I remember that. Listen, it's very important for your listeners to understand. Maybe I know a lot of Americans are getting extremely confused right now by the plethora of Islamist groups and all of these crazy different, you know, one is more extremist than the next, you know. Mm. But it's very important that the listeners understand that the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, which is the group that of which Morsi was a member, of which the ousted president was a member, and Hamas in the Gaza Strip, which is the group that just fought off the 51-day Israeli onslaught, that both of those groups are entirely different from these other wacko groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS and all these other crazy groups that cut off people's heads and call for international jihad and all of this stuff. I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas is an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, and these are groups that have like participated in elections, you know, have participated in and won internationally recognized elections. They have very specific political programs, you know, they have very specific visions and mission statements. And for the most part, you know, I mean, it's different with Hamas because of the occupation thing and the resistance. But it's certainly in the case of the Muslim Brotherhood, they do not espouse violence, you know, domestic violence for any reason whatsoever.
Well, and the key is
Hamas, of course.
The key, Adam, is what you said about standing for election, that they have made the decision basically permanently at the highest strategic kind of level that they are playing the Western game. Just like, you know, Iran with the IAEA and the nuclear program. Hey, look, we're going along with the deal. And that's what Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood have tried to do here. That's why Ayman al-Zawahiri has always denounced them as a bunch of sellouts and Westerners for playing the game. Because they keep trying to play the game. And so just like with the joint government there between Hamas and the PLA in the West Bank, it was basically, before the Israelis started a war over it, it was basically Hamas signing up for the PLA's approach to dealing with Israel and the United States toward, Palestinian state. That was Hamas basically ceding their goals in order to join up with the PLA. And then the punishment for that is war. You know, it's crazy.
Right. Right, right. Well, it's almost like the more moderate they become and the more reasonable they show themselves to be, the more in danger they put themselves, the more of a danger they become.
Yeah.
Like Israel will want to hit them immediately before they, you know, before they sort of reinvent themselves in a moderate, as a reasonable force or a moderate force, because then they would actually be, you know, then they wouldn't have an argument against them. They wouldn't be able to use force against them. They would have to deal with them, you know, as a political force.
Right.
So before they even have a chance to do that, they're
and,
struck,
and now,
you know?
You know, this is a group that has used suicide attacks against civilians in the past and that kind of thing. I mean, nobody's saying they're great guys, but the point being that, well, certainly the U.S. and Israel have arranged it so where they're the only political force the people of the Gaza Strip have. They don't have anybody
else
to choose from, really. You know,
and let's not forget that they too came via elections in January 2006, legislative elections that they swept.
Right.
This is Hamas in Gaza. I'm talking about.
Right. That America and Israel arranged.
Right.
All right. Anyway, so listen, man, I better let you go. I kept you over time here, but thanks so much for your time, Adam. It's great to talk to you again.
Hey, thanks, Scott. I hope to talk to you again soon.
All right. See ya. That's our friend Adam Morrow, everybody, reporting from Cairo there about the situation under the dictatorship of Field Marshal, is it Fatah al-Sisi, I think? Hang on, I got a cough. Hey, Al Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. Coming up this October 18th at Columbia University in New York, the Future Freedom Foundation is hosting a conference titled Stop the Wars on Drugs and Terrorism, featuring Glenn Greenwald, Radley Balco, Jeremy Scahill, Eugene Jarecki, Jonathan Turley, and others. The event is free and open to the public, but registration is required. Just head over to fff.org to sign up. That's the Stop the Wars on Drugs and Terrorism Conference, Saturday, October 18th, 2014, at Columbia University, sponsored by the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org.